Bienvenidos a todo mi gente aquí en Washington, D.C. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Distrito Colombia here on this Friday, August 29th, 2014. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and for this hour, we're going to spend the hour with Ed Morales, who's an independent journalist, and in addition, being an adjunct professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. He joins us over the phone, and we're going to speak about Latino stereotypes in Hollywood and in the news. And Ed Morales, can you hear me?
Yes.
Welcome
Good
to
afternoon.
The welcome to the show. You have an interview that appeared on the Norfolk American Congress on Latin America's website, NACLA, which is NACLA.org, and you interviewed Francis Negron Muntaner, among many other people, about a recent report that came out from the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race called The Latino Media Gap, a report on the state of Latinos in U.S. media. Now, Ed, can you tell us, if you can, when you got this report, what were the first things when you read this report? What were the first thing that first struck you? And if you can, briefly, if you can describe to us what you saw in the report in regards to the eight principal findings to create what is described as the Latino gap in the U.S. media?
Okay, sure. When I first got the report, it was exciting because I know that Professor Negron Muntaner had been working on it for a long time. She's the person who brought me on to the faculty at the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. But, we kind of have sporadic contracts, so I didn't know that it was going to be coming out as soon as it did when I got in touch with it. So I was surprised and excited. What I can say about the report is that it's very comprehensive. It combines a lot of strong statistical research with, Professor Negron Montaner's very skilled writing and point of view. I mean, she's written on a wide range of subjects concerning popular culture and also the Puerto Rican colonial conditions. And she's kind of like a brainy, writer. So it's not just a statistical analysis. So that's exciting, even though there are plenty of stats in the report. The main points that are made in the report, I'll list them briefly. you know, the other thing I should say is that one thing that I really liked about the report is that a lot of reports like this come out and they're usually just really doom and gloom, and they talk about the really bad statistics, but there's a lot in the report that addresses how things can change, and that there are hopeful things about the future for the way that Latinos kind of represent themselves in the media, you know. So there are eight main points, right? The first point is that there's a continued disproportionate presence of Latinos in entertainment and news on and off camera. So that means that there's a considerably lower percentage of Latinos who are involved in either producing news or entertainment or appearing on camera or being the subjects of the entertainment or the news. It's much lower than our percentage of the population, which, as you know, nationwide is about 17% right now. States like California, it's closer to 40%. So that is, you know, that's one of the main arguments about, you know, these kind of studies and the way that the Latinos try to advocate them for themselves is by citing the, you know, the percentage of how often we appear and how much we're involved compared to our actual numbers in the population. The second point is that she makes, which is kind of like a new point that I haven't seen made that much, is that on a gender level, there's an increase in the percentage of Latinas. Mm-hmm. In entertainment as opposed to male Latinos. And part of that is because she says that, you know, one of the classic stereotypes for Latinos in entertainment has been the stereotype of the Latin lover. And, you know, you might remember things like, you know, Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah.
And even to an extent, like Desi Arnaz was kind of a Latin lover, even though he was kind of a buffoon as well. There's another stereotype called a buffoon.
Yeah.
And so those men, and there's also Cesar Romero was one of the biggest Latin lovers in Hollywood. He like wound up playing the Joker on the original Batman.
That's right.
So this is a while ago, so I hope I'm not boring people with ancient history. But anyway, so you know, Professor Negron Montaner theorizes that for some reason in the past, these Latin lover figures were not threatening, I guess, to the white majority population, and for some reason now they're seen as more threatening, and so that's one of the reasons. And then also another reason for the increase in Latinas is that there's a new stereotype now, which is the maid. You know, in the past, if you're a student of Hollywood, you remember that it used to be the African Americans were the stereotypical maid. I think the first African American actress to win an Academy Award or an actor at any level was a woman who played a maid. I don't remember her name, but she was. That was a really big thing. So now, and also because you know, I mean, in my work as well as in Negron Montaner's work, we both noted that. In general, the image of Latinos in the media over the last 10 or 15 years has really strongly shifted towards representing Latinos as recent immigrants and, you know, lower skilled people with not a very good command of the language. So that's another reason why Latinos sort of fit into that.
I think you may have been referring to Hattie McDaniel from Gone with the Wind.
Hattie McDaniel, exactly right. Good for you. That's it. Then then there's an analysis of, you know, why should we be concerned with stereotypes?
And exactly. And
so she talks about, well, they have harmful effects. I mean, more and newer racist attitudes are created. You know, we talk about like how you know, we're supposed to be getting past the age of racism after the civil rights movement. Well, actually, you know, the events in Ferguson recently have really seemed to be put an end to the whole idea of post-racial society. But if you're still thinking along those lines, you know, you can say, well, the greaser bandito of the early 20th century, which was used to represent Mexicans and Mexican-Americans, that may have disappeared. But if you have new stereotypes, you know, then, you know, this is the new things that harm Latinos, you know, on a long-term basis, you know, from everything to getting educational opportunities to job interviews, residential discrimination. So all of these things, you know, we can't dismiss, you know, entertainments or depictions on the news as just, you know, casual things that don't have anything to do with anything. They begin to permeate, you know, the mindset of the American people and help to reinforce racial attitudes or racist attitudes that, you know, were thought of, you know, that we were leaving behind, but they're reinforced, and so it makes it more difficult for Latinos.
Exactly, and that's the crux of the issue that we're speaking of. Mm-hmm. That's at the matter of hand right now is, do the stereotypes of Latinos in Hollywood and in the news matter? Yes, they do. Absolutely. I could tell you that as a Salvadoran, every once in a while when I watch TV, whenever I see a certain crime drama, you know, cops and robbers type stuff on TV, if there's any mention of one of the characters being Salvadoran, my immediate feeling is, oh, don't let it be something in regards to gangs or or something along the lines of immigration. And sure enough, if it's something that's gang related, they're going to mention almost something, you know, vaguely or not, something in regards to MS-13. And I just get that feeling like, oh God, don't let it be that episode. And it brings up, you know, my next question that I want to ask you is, you know, one of the most important things in the report that I saw is how hard news affects the creation of stereotypes, because it's not just Hollywood and movies and television, you know, those sort of things, but also the news as well. And for me, when I see something that's related to a Salvadoran such as myself, it's sort of typecast into something that's either gang related or immigration related. So do you, as a journalist yourself, do you see news coverage more important than Hollywood stereotypes or vice versa? It's sort of the question of which came first, the chicken or the egg, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, probably news reporting is, you know, the ultimate origin of this, because, you know, when you even go back and you look at newspapers from the 19th century, I mean, they always have these racist descriptions of, you know, people from different countries, you know, including Mexicans and Latin Americans, but also Asians. Sometimes they were used to justify things, you know, like wars, you know, like the Spanish-American War, or wars against Asian countries. So, you know, all that happened before you got a really, you know, the absorption of Latinos into the United States, like say after the Mexican War and then the the Spanish-American War, you know, which caused a lot of Caribbean Latinos to come. So sure, all that stuff began before the entertainments, you know, with the, I think that, you know, a lot of the stereotypes that you see in Hollywood entertainment are based on, you know, the way that the news presents Latinos, and now it's still a problem. You know, the very large percentage of the characters that appear, well, I can talk about both things. You know, a large percentage of the characters that appear in entertainment, film or television, are criminals. You know, then, you know, the positive balance is that there's many of them are cops, you know, and in a strange way, it's, you know, even though cops are seen as positive members of the community, you know, there's that old idea about the fact that cops and even prison guards inhabit the same milieu that criminals do, and sort of it's almost like they're inseparable. And so you don't see like Latino professionals, or, you know, with the exception of like a show like maybe like Ugly Betty, you know, or Latinos involved in other things that are outside of, you know, either being criminal or criminal enforcement. And then the same thing in the news representations, you know, so many of the appearances of Latinos in news have to do with arrests for drug trafficking, or, you know, the kind of fear-mongering that goes on about immigration. And then, of course, like undocumented immigrants, there was a big fight over, you know, getting the press not to use the word illegal. You know, I mean, that was going on for a long time with the press. It took like a long time to convince the New York Times, you know, which is not exactly on the border of Texas, you know.
And that only happened this year.
The illegal, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And the Washington Post, too, I imagine. I mean, you've been following that down there, right? Their use of the word illegal, right?
Exactly.
So, it's pervasive, and, you know, and if when a study like this shows, you know, it gives you the breakdown. It gives you the total amount of times that Latino stories appear in major newscasts or in the print media, and then it gives you the percentage of, you know, what they were about. And so Latinos are just always problematized. They're like pathologies. And we haven't really gotten far from the sociology of the 1960s and 1970s. The only thing they talked about regarding Latinos was, you know, how they were a big problem because they continued to live in poverty and, you know, didn't advance, and, you know, these sort of anthropological studies about all the pathologies in the Latino community.
You know, I'm along the lines of believing that the news media, the stereotypes that are created in the news media, eventually bleed into Hollywood and TV and film and all those sort of things. I remember quite vividly an episode of NCIS where not only was the episode based on the Salvadoran gang MS-13, but they even went so far to say that MS-13 had links to Al-Qaeda. And this was on network television, you know, on prime time. And this was something that, you know, on any other show, on any other news outlet, that's been dismissed as ridiculous. But on a prime time show with millions of people watching, especially on a popular show like that one, they actually said that on the air. And I was so shocked that, you know, under any other outlet, that's easily dismissed.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely, you know, the right-wing Republican discourse has been touching on that. Like, I think that the Texas Governor Rick Perry recently talked about, you know, one of the reasons to control the border is that Islamic militants were slipping in from Mexico. I think, you know, even recently, like, we're seeing a lot of this emphasis of members of the ISIS group were Americans or people from England who like rap music, and that to me is very scary, whether it's true or not. I mean, just the overemphasis of it is just seems to almost start constructing this idea that, you know, there is a parallel between, you know, radical Islamic terrorism and, you know, and street culture in the United States that blacks and Latinos, you know, participate in. That's, you know, to me, that's very scary. And, it's a very it's a troubling thing that I'm seeing in the media lately.
You know, if you follow the U.S. Census, especially the most recent one back in 2010, the Latino population in the United States is perhaps equal or greater to that now of the African American population as a whole. And as you said, that the report is not entirely doom and gloom, because there have been progresses made in certain aspects of, you know, casting in Hollywood for Latino actors and actresses. But yet there's still this one unique phenomenon that still exists today, and that is the phenomenon of Latino actors who do not acknowledge their heritage from time to time. Now, this is not something new. We could go back to the 40s and 50s when Richie Valens, who sang La Bamba, His original last name was Valenzuela, if I'm not mistaken. Right. And, you know, the legend has it that he changed or modified his last name to make it more acceptable for the English-speaking audience in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And he certainly got his claim to fame on that. And he's not the first or the last person who's done that. With that said, that was back in the 50s. And yet, for some reason or another, you know, this phenomenon of certain Latinos who do not acknowledge, you know, their heritage, change their last name or change their name entirely to sound more American. You know, I've never understood that, and it's something that still happens today. And there's even a link on your interview, you know, showing a list of people who you didn't know were Latinos, and it's nothing sort of shocking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a lot of levels to that. You know, I'm not one to condone it, but you know, I can tell you that there are reasons for it. You know, and the main reason is that since Latino culture is not valued in the society, then you know, Latinos who are trying to make it with their art, whatever they're doing, music or acting, if they feel like they disguise or hide their Latino identity, then they have a better chance at success. You know, it's not something that I admire or respect, but the motivation, you know, is there. If we had a society that really valued Latino culture, then I'm sure all these people would come out and, you know, not hide who they were. So, you know, there's a lot of that. You know, a lot of the things too about the Latinos that you didn't know were Latino is that there are a lot of, you know, it goes to show you, like, you know, that there's a lot of a class and racial diversity in Latin America, and some of the people who are on lists like that are either, you know, from mixed marriages where only one parent is Latino, and so they take the other parent's last name, and, you know, maybe they're lighter skinned. They could be lighter skinned from Latin America, and a lot of people don't realize that there is a lighter skinned elite in most Latin American countries that don't, you know, that are not discriminated against, and in fact pretty much run those countries. And so when they come to the United States, they don't come because they're escaping persecution or they don't have a job or they're dirt poor. They come because, you know, they were able to study in a good university in the United States, or they got an opportunity. And so they come here, and many times the elite in Latin America don't have the Hispanic last names, because there are Europeans that went to Latin America that have, you know, like Germanic last names.
Exactly.
Or French last names. And so they come here with those names, and so then they have light skin. They don't have the Hispanic last name. And so they don't really, they aren't even changing anything, you know. So, you know, they're just passing. You know, and it's basically, it's about passing, you know. And, you know, it's something that really exists all around the world. I mean, you know, even in Asia and Africa, you know, there's discrimination against people who are darker skinned within the groups. You know, in Asia, like, lighter skinned Asians discriminate against darker skinned Asians. So, you know, that's kind of a result of that. And, you know, I think some of these performers feel like, why should I bring on this discrimination against myself if, you know, I can pass? Now, you know, then there's another thing, too, where there's a lot of Afro-Latinos who often aren't really even accepted by mainstream Latinos. Like, say, like someone like Zoe Saldana, you know, who most of her parts are either as Afro-Latino or just not even mentioning what her ethnicity is. And so because she's dark, I guess people look at her as being a light-skinned black person, like maybe Halle Berry or something like that. And so she doesn't want to disrupt, you know, her path to success. And so even though she will openly say that she's Latina, it's not something that she emphasizes in wanting to do these roles, or, you know, she's looking to continue this career of being in action roles, you know, which is, you know, very good for her. Now, like in the past, you know, a lot of people passed because there was a really a much more strong discrimination. You know, like, you know, one of the favorite things that I teach in one of my classes, there was this group, I don't know if you know, from Flint, Michigan. They were called Question Mark and the Mysterians. And they were all
That's way back from the 60s.
And they used the radical strategy of just sort of disguising themselves as aliens in a way. You know, they wore like these science fiction costumes. And it really worked for them because 96 Tears is one of the classic songs of the garage rock lexicon. And, you know, you really, you can talk to a million rock critics and they will not know that Question Mark and the Mysterians were Mexican American.
Oh, that goes way back, but
yeah.
I remember that record. I saw that video, and the first thing I said, like, oh, those aren't aliens. I know just by looking at the lead singer, but that's another.
And the other thing too is, yeah, I don't mean to cut you off, but you know, another thing too is like the strategy of a lot of rappers, like Puerto Rican rappers in New York, they would not. If they were dark-skinned, they would, like, not use their Latin names. They'd change it to an American or an Anglo-sounding name, and they would pass as African-Americans. So people also pass as African-Americans as well. So it's not always about, you know, passing as white. It's because African-Americans have a presence in the country that, you know, is valued more than Latinos in terms of culture. I'm not saying that Latinos are more discriminated against or there's a stronger racism against them. But in terms of culture, African Americans have a stronger presence that's more valued. I mean, look at how many people like jazz and hip hop, you know, and compare that to people who like salsa and Latin music.
Another example of that is Immortal Technique. Even though he's from Peru, there's nothing in his name that even gives a hint or a mention of his heritage as a result. Right. That's quite an interesting thing, and you've sort of covered it already, but, you know, we've mentioned before that, you know, there aren't that enough Latinos, based on the report, in regards to lead actor roles or leadership roles in regards to writing and directing. For Afro-Latinos, who make up a small sub-portion of that Latino community, they've nonetheless have made strides in leading some roles. You mentioned Zoe Saldana, for example. Why the sudden rise within Afro-Latino roles?
Yeah, I think that Professor Negron Mutaner talks about the fact that a lot of it has to do with the passing as African American in those cases. If you take like one of the examples that's kind of a stretch is the woman who won the Academy Award for 12 Years a Slave, who's Lupita, right?
Yes.
So she's actually African, but she grew up in Mexico, so, you know, she's considered a Latina on that level. That's not a really typical example, but it is kind of an example of someone who really is Latino in a way, even though she's not born Latino from a Latino. She's raised in Mexico, and so she, and her name is Lupita, which is actually a Spanish name, right?
Yeah, exactly.
From Guadalupe. but, because of her appearance, you know, there are more roles, you know, even though African Americans also suffer from lack of proportional presence in both entertainment and news, there are still more roles for African Americans. So, you know, that's one example. And so I think that's the reason she points out. And I think that in a sense, In a way, really, there shouldn't be that much of a problem with that happening because, like I say, a lot of Afro-Latinos have difficulty being accepted by Latinos in general. So if they, you know, connect with or feel comfortable playing African-American roles who are also underrepresented, then it's almost like a form of empowerment in that way. I mean, do we really need to force people to represent Latino all the time? You know, I do think that there should be more Latino representation and there should be more roles and they should be serious roles, and they shouldn't be like these continued attempts at these sort of lame comedies that, you know, it seems like it's been a long time before we really see, you know, some serious representation of Latinos in film and television that are roles that, you know, are not these sort of simplistic, let's laugh at, you know, the fact that, you know, I don't know, there's an intermarriage between a Mexican-American and a Cuban, and, like, one likes tortilla and the other one likes black beans. And, you know, it's like, why can't, you know, Latinos be represented as families that have lived in America for, you know, 50 years, and there's been someone, there's damage to the family because there was a Vietnam vet, and then there's one who went to law school but dropped out because they feel like they didn't fit in with the Ivy League. You know, I mean, you never see things like that. You know, and that's really what we're living through.
Yeah, yeah. And as the population grows, there should be the more greater likelihood that there should be stories like that as a result. We're going to take a short break right here. We're speaking with Ed Morales, who's an independent journalist and adjunct professor at Columbia University Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. We're going to take a short break right here. This is Latino Media Collective. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Live music, man. Nothing would transform you like a live music experience.
That's the voice of the great saxophonist Henry Threadgill, reminding us of the importance of live music. Transparent Productions has been presenting the best live, freeform, and avant-garde jazz music in the D.C. area for almost two decades, and we're honored that WPFW 89.3 FM, your jazz and justice radio station, is collaborating with us by serving as the media sponsor for our upcoming 18th season. Our season, called Sundays at 7 at the Caverns, kicks off on September with three great performances. German saxophonist Ingrid Laubrock starts things off on September 7th with her quintet that includes the great saxophonist Tim Burns. Performances continue on September 14th with alto saxophonist Darius Jones leading a quartet featuring vocalist Emily Lesbros. And the month concludes on September 28th with a trio date led by the wonderful pianist Cooper Moore. All performances take place at the historic Bohemian Caverns located at 2001 11th Street Northwest in the U Street section of Adams Morgan's in Washington, D.C. All shows are Sundays, two sets, and sets are at 7 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. You can purchase advance tickets online via bohemiancaverns.com or get further information by going to transparentproductionsdc.org. And as always, with Transparent Productions performances, 100% of the proceeds goes directly to the artists.
Live music, man, nothing would transform you like a live music experience.
Also, listen to the show live, as well as listen to some of our previous shows at WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. We're speaking with Ed Morales about Latino stereotypes in Hollywood and the news. He has an interview that's out on the NACLA website. That's the North American Congress on Latin America. His interview with Francis Negron Montaner regarding the Latino media gap, a report on the state of Latinos in U.S. media. Ed, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here, yeah.
So I want to ask you, we spoke earlier this week in regards for the interview, and one of the things I wanted to ask you was the role of gender and how it plays in recent developments on the report. Now, when I spoke to you on Monday in regards to being interviewed today, there was a little controversy developing at the time, and that is from the Emmy Awards, regarding Sofia Vergara. And the controversy stems about, you know, a little skit that they did on the Emmy Awards where they had her standing on a pedestal while it was rotating, and they were, you know, for lack of a better term, many people felt that she was being objectified, you know, as a result of this skit that was done. Many people in the media, you know, criticized the bit that was done, that it objectified women or objectified Sofia as a Latina. And I have no problem with her. Wish her all the success in the world. She responded by saying, you know, people should lighten up, that, you know, it's just a joke on her. It's just a little bit of fun. You know, people need to lighten up. But since we're talking about the issue of stereotypes, you know, in Hollywood and in the media, you know, I took that incident at a second glance. And one of the things I had to ask myself, you know, was that, you know, would the same thing be okay if they had an African-American actress doing the same thing, being put on a pedestal and objectified as a statue, much the same way as Sophia was? So I want to ask you, you know, to get your opinion on that little incident, if you're even aware of it.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I was aware of it. I mean, you know, I think one thing about the difference, I don't think they would ever do that with an African-American, but I think the reason for that is, you know, the history of slavery in this country and the fact that, you know, Africans were bought and sold, you know, and put on, if not on pedestals, you know, on some kind of platform so people could look at them, you know, and decide whether they wanted to buy them or not. So I think that would be a little bit too much for them to do. The thing about Sofia Vergara and that is that, you know, well, the odd thing about it is that, you know, one of the old stereotypes about Latin women is the Latin Spitfire, right? And so the reason why that was criticized, because the Latin Spitfire, you know, goes back to Lupe Velez and it continues all the way through to the 60s and stuff. And the reason why it was supposed to be a negative stereotype is that it portrayed Latinas as being oversexed, or just, you know, that everything about them is just about sex, you know, whereas whatever, white women, you know, had a personality or something, and it wasn't all about sex. But well, the strange thing that's happened in our society is that, you know, this trend has happened where, you know, part of it is feminism and part of it is like the sensationalism of the media, which women are now encouraged to be very sexual. And so this includes, you know, white women. And, you know, when you look at something like Miley Cyrus, you know, trying to channel big black women's behinds on the Video Music Award last year, and it's really clear, you know, that there's, and then even the Video Music Award this year was like this incredible display of, like, you know, women, you know, objectifying their bodies, you know, particularly their posterior, which is, you know, Francis, Professor Negron Montaner wrote a very interesting essay about Jennifer Lopez's use of her backside, you know,
okay,
kind of a symbolic. So you see, the thing is, we're now in an era where women seem to be accepting the idea of using their body to empower themselves. But still, you know, the pedestal thing, you know, I didn't actually see it, but it didn't seem like actually like in the same spirit of, say, the women on the Video Music Awards aggressively, you know, flaunting their bodies and engaging and, you know, moving their bodies in a sexual way. This was just like this pedestal thing. And then the funny thing is that the pedestal image, and I don't know if anybody's really talking about this, is like this critique of Latinas towards the machismo, you know, that Latin men are supposed to be different from Anglo men because they put them on a pedestal, which is in a way like, you know, sort of saying, well, I'm going to treat you like a queen, but in a way, you know, they're enslaving them in that way. So, you know, all that stuff is in there. You know, Sofia Vergara is really kind of like she's doing the Desi Arnaz act, except, you know, a female version, you know, and this is controversial. You know, like, I'm not happy with, you know, the way that she is represented as this, you know, the central Latino in the whole entertainment world, because, you know, she uses this fractured English, and like I said, see, I think there's a big problem where, you know, 65% or more of Latinos are, or 70% are not first-generation immigrants, you know, and like close to that percentage, English is our dominant language. So when you get like someone like Sofia Vergara being the dominant image of Latinos in the United States, I think it's representing a negative stereotype, which is that we don't know how to speak English. You know, on the other hand, it's kind of cool that, you know, someone who has trouble with English can be as assertive as Sofia Vergara, and I see the value in that. I just think it would be better if Sofia Vergara was like one of like 10 or 15 major personalities. You know, that, well, we could say she represents the recent immigrants. Fine. You know, there's plenty of those. But that's not, you know, that shouldn't be the dominant image of Latinos in the United States, because it perpetuates this idea that we just got here when, you know, our culture predates the Anglo culture in this hemisphere. You know, so it's kind of ridiculous. So, I noticed that, and, I didn't really see it, so I can't comment that strongly about it, but the elements of the pedestal, you know, I can understand why people, you know, it's very possible that, you know, that people objected to it because it was such a old-fashioned way of displaying women, you know, whereas now, like, TV is constantly filmed with images of women, like, really, you know, being very, you know, physically sexual, aggressive, you know, in their appearance and in music videos and television shows, and, you know.
Well, let me ask you something here, because yeah. we don't want to turn this entirely to the Sofia Vergara chat, but yeah. She's one of a few actresses who had originally made a name for themselves in the Spanish-speaking media, and mm-hmm. one of the few that made the transition from Spanish-speaking media to where she is now in the English-speaking world, where she's pretty much known throughout the country now. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I look at the Spanish-speaking media from time to time, you know, we all know about... You know, at least we do, about novellas and how prevalent they are in the Spanish-speaking media. And sometimes I feel like there are some shows or some programming within the Spanish-speaking media that sort of reinforce certain, you know, stereotypes. You know,
yeah.
You mentioned earlier, you know, that the concept of the black maid has made a transition now to... The consensus is a Latina maid. You could still find a black maid in a Spanish-speaking programming or TV drama or something of that sort. You know, do you look that into account, you know, in regards to, you know, sometimes how Spanish-speaking media can help portray some of these stereotypes as well?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a big problem in Latin America. I mean, there's still... In Peru, there was a controversy about one of the more popular, this is, I think it's 2 years ago, I don't know if it's the program is still on the air, but one of the most popular comedies featured a man in blackface and a wig. And blackface is, you know, not unusual in countries like Colombia and Peru and many Latin American countries. So, yeah, that kind of overt racism towards Afro-Latinos gets, you know, it can be overt, but and it also can be through complete exclusion, you know, which is represented in the telenovelas, where, you know, you rarely get any characterization of of Afro-Latinos, or even just, you know, indigenous Latinos that are not assimilated mestizos, you know, if you know what I'm talking about. You know, because in Latin America, the model for the accepted society is the light-skinned people and then the lighter-skinned mestizos who have a hint of indigenous in their look, but they're, you know, they don't have any indigenous customs or, you know, they're not in touch with the language. So, you know, African descent and indigenous descent gets discriminated against in Latin America, which, you know, most people find surprising because people look at Latin Americans and they think, well, you know, you have you're mixed race and you have a hint of African or a hint of indigenous in you. So how could there be? And the Latin Americans themselves don't believe that there is racism, but there is. And so this gets transmitted through not only the shows in Latin America, it's a separate thing from what we see like, in Univision and Telemundo and, the other Mexican, network, whose name escapes me. Where, you know, you can get some overt racism and then you can get the complete exclusion of, of African and indigenous people, in these shows. And, so that's a negative thing, you know, for the Latinos that live in almost like teaches them how to, you know, maintain discriminatory feelings now in their new home in the United States.
One of the most biggest offenders, probably the oldest offender, is the character of La... Many people may not know it, but the character of La India María, which is a character that not only looks indigenous, but has speaks Spanish with an indigenous accent as well. This character still exists today in stations like Univision and Telemundo, and it's still shocking that it's still relevant in the Spanish-speaking media, but that's I've always felt that in some there's some aspects of you know, outlets like television, Telemundo and Univision that are just decades behind the times and that sort of thing. Now, one thing you mentioned also a few moments ago is you sort of made the difference between Latin Americans and U.S.-born Latinos, you know. In the report, you know, I'm curious to know, in your opinion, why is there a need to make that distinction between U.S.-born Latinos and Latin Americans? Because not many people may not understand why that is the case to begin with.
Well, I mean, as I hinted at before, there's a difference between U.S.-born Latinos and Latin Americans largely because the motivation, the reason why people, you know, the main reason Latinos have migrated to the United States is because of economic and racial and class discrimination. So the people that wind up here tend to be darker skinned, less accumulated wealth, less education. And Latin Americans are Latin Americans because they didn't have to leave. So they're usually better connected, they're closer to the elite. They have been better educated in Latin America, or they have better educational opportunities when they come to the United States. And they don't necessarily make a strong connection to the struggles of U.S. Latinos. And they're also favored on so many levels, you know, in so many different areas, like in academia, in the arts. You know, there's been a big struggle here in the Museo del Barrio. I don't know if you know about it, here in East Harlem, which was originally a community museum that was created by Puerto Ricans and other working class Latinos. And over the years, they have kind of transformed themselves into becoming like a Latin American museum that, you know, has a lot of shows that promote big time Latin American artists. And there's been a lot of you know, there's almost no Puerto Ricans now on staff in the Museo del Barrio. Is all, you know, highly educated, you know, museum professionals from Latin America or of Latin American background. The other thing, and you know, when we want to get back to the media thing, it's more true in the entertainment. You know, like in the news media, traditionally the original Latino members in the news media in the United States come from working class backgrounds. You know, they're the brightest kids from the barrios who, you know, worked hard and became journalists. You know, like Salazar, the guy who was killed in Los Angeles, and Juan Gonzalez, who was in the Daily News, he was a Young Awards member. But in entertainment, you know, you get a lot more focus now on, you know, because there's a lot, there's success in Mexican cinema. So you got like a guy like Alfonso Cuarón, who I actually met and interviewed once, and he's a very pleasant guy. You know, I like Alfonso Cuarón. But he comes from a relatively privileged situation in Mexico, where he was able to make several films in Mexico, and then, you know, his film aesthetic is closer to European film aesthetic. That's another thing that happens. In Latin America, the university and the arts, they train you to have more of a European aesthetic. So when these people actually create these films, they kind of got like this cachet of, you know, making these films that are kind of like European films. And then you get the Spanish actors who are not Latin Americans. And they are also disproportionately represented. You know, when you talk about who are the Latinos, the big Latinos in Hollywood, you know, there's a high percentage of Spanish actors, you know, in that. But it's like I said, it's different from the news media, which does have a lot of, U.S. Latinos. And I think, you know, the big problem now with the news media more than anything else, and it's across the board, is that right now it's pretty much the Ivy Leagues and the, you know, the really top private schools that those are the only people that are being hired for influential media jobs. It's not like it used to be where a lot of people in journalism came out of working class backgrounds, striving. They knew the streets and they knew the language, and so that's how they got in. Now you get a lot of people who are, you know, coming out of Ivy League universities who are not necessarily that connected to the communities that they're supposed to be covering.
Now, let me play devil's advocate here for a second, because if somebody comes up to you and says, Ed, you know, I don't speak Spanish, I don't care, not interested in the community, why should I care about this, especially when the Spanish community has their own television stations, they have their own radio stations, you know, if you can't cut it in the English media, you can always work there. So what would you say to somebody who would say, why bother with the English media when there are other outlets that are in other people's languages? Because in the 8 years I've done this show, I could tell you that we will get those phone calls every once in a while where somebody will say, I don't care about what's going on in Guatemala or in Mexico or something of that nature. What do you tell to those people who are listening right now who may dismiss, you know, everything that's been discussed?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, that's, again, it kind of goes back to the problem that I was talking about before. It's a big problem, and actually it's been kind of a shift. Like, I would say, like, about 20 years ago or 15 years ago when they had the Latin pop explosion, and you had Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony, it seemed like there was a belief that, and then you had, like, TV shows like Resurrection Boulevard. I don't know if you've ever heard of that show. Mm-hmm. Like, by this guy, Dennis Leone, who's a great Mexican-American L.A. director, you know, who really should have more opportunities. There was a brief period where there was a belief that U.S. Latinos should really get out there and, you know, and create Latino-oriented entertainment. But then the big corporate powers that be, I mean, seemed to decide that this was not profitable and the only way to reach Latinos was through Spanish-language media. But it doesn't make any sense, because it's a minority of Latinos who have Spanish as their dominant language. Look, we're doing a show in English. There's a lot of people out there who are Latinos who want to listen to the show, and they're going to have trouble. I had to work really hard to maintain the level of Spanish that I have. You know, I write a column in Spanish for a website in Puerto Rico, and I work really hard on it because I cared about retaining the language, but it's not easy. So most of us, really, who are U.S. Latinos, we've been here for several generations. Our dominant language is English. And even though at times we can sit with our relatives and say, all right, like, I'll watch Sábado Gigante or whatever is that stuff there, it's not really, you know, it's just more about, you know, sharing something with your family or your older relatives, and it's not really directed, you know, at us. And, you know, or I could say, all right, well, if we were only 20% of Latinos and there 80% of Latinos were Spanish dominant, then I would say it made sense. But that's not the case. You know, the case is that, and we have also, what doesn't make any sense about the way that the media corporations have handled this is that, you know, we're the ones that are getting educated and have the most consumer buying power. But instead, what they'd rather do is, you know, put all the money in the Spanish language television and sell people, you know, like a fabric softener or, you know, McDonald's in Spanish, you know, and I think it's that they just don't want to deal with it. You know, this is at the basis of the work that I do, which is the idea that, you know, Latinos really, we're like a mixed hybrid culture where, you know, we don't necessarily want to leave our old culture behind. And we're mixing our old culture with the new culture, and we're doing it in English, and we're doing it in Spanish. And they just don't understand how to develop marketing models, you know, on that level. And so they just give up, and they want to do the easy thing, you know, either one way or the other. But, you know, what I always say is that I think it actually it's a great opportunity for Latinos in this country not to have a lot of targeted entertainment and consumerism directed at them. Because what it does is that it keeps us, like, on the outside with a critical eye and not necessarily, like, just buying in to a lot of the, you know, anti-intellectual, you know, crap culture of the United States, you know, where we can maintain a critical distance, you know, and have a kind of an independence. You know, I don't necessarily advocate for shows that, you know, portray obedient, mindless Latinos on national television. I think that actually we're lucky that we don't have those.
Well put. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We've been speaking with Ed Morales, an independent journalist and adjunct professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race.
Good afternoon. These are the headlines. I am Gloria Minot. Prosecutors urge jurors today to focus on two questions at the corruption trial of former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell and his wife Maureen. Why did a businessman give the couple more than $165,000 in gifts and loans? And why did the McDonnells accept? The answer, prosecutor David Harbaugh said in his closing argument, was what he called a corrupt understanding. The McDonnells needed money because they were badly in debt, and he said they were willing to undertake official acts to help former Star Scientific Inc. CEO Johnny Williams promote his tobacco-based supplement. The McDonnells are charged in federal court in a 14-count indictment and could face decades in prison if convicted. They're being tried together, but have their own attorneys who will give their closing arguments later today. U.S. and European intelligence officials are increasingly worried about lone wolf terrorist attacks by their own citizens returning from fighting in Syria and Iraq. They cite the case of a Frenchman who spent 11 months fighting with the Islamic State group in Syria before returning to France to act out his rage. Prosecutors say that France's Mehdi Nemmouche methodically shot four people at the Jewish Museum in central Brussels in May. Three died instantly, one afterwards. Nemmouche was arrested later, apparently by chance. Officials worry about radicalized Europeans and Americans who have gone to fight with the extremists that they will return undetected to carry out attacks. There may now be 100 Americans fighting for extremist groups in Syria and Iraq. Such Europeans number in the thousands. She has expensive tastes, owns a lot of land in Zimbabwe, and is now entering politics, a move that is roiling this southern African nation that has known only one leader since independence, President Robert Mugabe, who is 90 years old. The newcomer is Mugabe's 49-year-old wife, Grace, who accepted a nomination last month to lead the ruling party's women's wing, triggering accusations that Mugabe aims to set a political dynasty in place. Her nomination has already caused infighting in the ZANU-PF ruling party, with some claiming they've been intimidated. The ZANU-PF Women's League said they hope Mrs. Mugabe can advance women's issues and help heal wounds because she has the president's ear. College students from West Africa may be subject to extra health checks when they arrive to study in the United States as administrators try to insulate campuses from the worst Ebola outbreak in history. With the virus continuing to kill in Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Nigeria, the expected arrival of thousands of students from those countries has some authorities on alert, cautioning against alarm. Acknowledging he didn't get it right, a 2-game suspension for Ravens running back Ray Rice, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced tougher penalties for players accused of domestic violence, including 6 weeks for a first offense and at least a year for a second. In a letter sent to 32 team owners Thursday and obtained by the Associated Press, Goodell never mentions Rice by name but makes clear references to the Baltimore player who was charged with assault after being caught on video dragging his then-fiancée off a casino elevator. Since January of 2000, 77 players have been involved in 85 domestic violence incidents, with 6 being cut by their teams, according to USA Today's NFL Arrests database. The NFL suspended 6 players for 1 game each, and Rice was the 2nd player to be suspended for 2 games. Those are the headlines. Up next, the Jay Winter Night Wolf Show. Askia Mohammed has 255 headlines. I'm Gloria Minot.
Peace, this is Atan Thomas, and you're listening to WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.